On today's episode, Taller Cranston.
Okay, it's rolling.
It's rolling, people.
I got nothing. I don't know what to say.
Welcome to Oakland. Oh, I'll start that one again. Okay, Paul, I have to tell you, Taller Cranston, that was a thrill to be able to get that interview done. I was at the World Figure Skating Championships. I had phoned Taller in Mexico to see if he was willing to do it. He was very gracious and said that he would. And then trying to track him down when I was glued to a seat doing commentary was actually tricky. But you know, back when I was a kid, Taller Cranston is 10 years older than I am. So, you know, I would have been like a 10, 11 year old, and he was, you know, a young man in his 20s, if you do the math. And here was this unbelievable, like a rare bird on the ice with that sort of drama and excitement and grace. I mean, he was really quite something. So to be able to fast forward all these years, and he's so well known as an artist now, to be able to talk to him a little bit about the process. I mean, what do you remember about Taller? Probably nothing, because you're a baby.
Well, I mean, I thought that was the fascinating part about it, is that he talked about his skating and all that stuff, but such a big part of his life was being an artist. And when I talk to, you know, musicians, and I talk to actors and other people that we've been interviewing, I'm always curious, because I always sort of think, or I have this theory, one of my theories, that there's something maybe perhaps that somebody saw, like if a musician heard a piece of music, or they saw something when they were younger and it sort of influenced them or encouraged them to pursue this kind of thing. But he said it, I think, in your interview, that he was just always an artist.
Yeah.
That was sort of his thing. And it's so ingrained in his personality that it's he basically blew my theory out of the water. So
Well, do you know what? And as interesting as his art is, what was more interesting to me was to try to get to the bottom of his process. So from that standpoint, let's listen. Taller Cranston. He is a Canadian icon, world and Olympic bronze medalist, recipient of the Order of Canada, inductee into the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame, Canadian Figure Skating Hall of Fame, and is now on Canada's Walk of Fame. Off the ice, he has produced and sold over 20,000 works of art, over 250 one-man exhibitions throughout the world. Taller Cranston, I am so pleased to be able to talk to you.
And here I am.
And here you are. Okay, I want to start here. Back in the day, you were very interested in astrology, and I always thought of us as kindred spirits, and I'll tell you why. You're born on April 2-0, I'm born on April 02. We're 10 months apart, both Aries spirited. Are you still into all that?
I'm going to be slow. I am slow. I'm an artist, and I have to correct you on one thing.
Uh-oh.
It's not 20,000, it's 70,000 paintings that I would have sold worldwide.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. And in the exhibition all over the world, it's 500 and not 200.
I'm so sorry. I'm incorrect.
Well, no, it's just one of those things. And, you know, details become important.
Yes,
I'm an artist. And artists all over the world, and in history and the history of civilization, are very unique and special kinds of human beings that would have a reservoir of enormous sensitivity. That's one of the strengths and weaknesses of artists. With regard to astrology, numerology, and anything else that proffers information which is not exactly technical, that would be important to me, certainly important to Da Vinci and others.
Is it important to me?
Yes, but I don't live my life by it. But what it does is it usually confirms information. I got a honorary doctorate at Carleton a year ago, and flying in the face of some of my ambassadorial friends who thought this was sort of a bit hokey, but one of the 10 points that I think was important for me to tell the graduates was read the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall can come from sources like astrology,
yeah,
numerology, or actually something even bigger than all of it, which is nature. And I am always looking to nature, the elements, for answers. And all those answers for absolutely everything are there if one has the eyes to see it or the ears to hear it. So am I still interested in it? Yes. One must be kind of out of the sphere of influence, because people that think that astrological predictions are, you know, the way to go are making a mistake. I don't think that, but I think that astrology would help you understand the climate of what is around you, the temperature of the air, and actually in a more specific, basic way, is whether or not it's the time to move or the time to hold back. That's okay. Very, very important, to be aggressive or to be sort of careful.
And where are you now in terms of climate?
Where I am, I have always lived, an erratic, creative life. That's something I cannot really change. And when I was maybe like 16 in Montreal, in this sort of Indian restaurant where a fellow sort of read my palm, it was important because it was reiterated 3 times in my life post that. And one of the things that he said was, you will never have money, but you will never not have money.
Okay.
63 years of age, as I am today, soon to be 64. That is absolutely true. I've really lived very high on the hog. I am guilty of that. And where I am today is very much in harmony with self, my work and everything that I do. Actually, even in harmony with myself as whether I can stand living with myself. I mean, most of the years I can't, but right now
it's okay.
Right now it's okay. But in the, like, where I am department, and maybe this is just typical and normal for me, but part of me, I think this is maybe naive, wants to change. I actually think it's time to grow up. I don't know if
what
that's
does that
possible.
Mean?
To be kind of more mature, embrace obligations, professional and other obligations, and many people around me say, why bother? It's not good to do that. Because in growing up, you start to embrace a certain maturity that, say, immature people don't have, which can make them more interesting, in fact, more childlike.
I think you're right.
But the thing is, I really do think it's time, and so where I am right now is hungering for, as I have done so many times, a change, something different, and even in the town that I live in, which is Mexican town, wonderful, great, fantastic, part of me would not be reticent to sort of think, what about Ecuador? What about Argentina? Definitely not Europe, and definitely not Asia, and not Africa, but part of me wants the child in me wants to once again try something new. I don't know whether that can happen. I don't know whether I'm too old for that. But part of me lusts for change, and I am rife to do it.
You know, it's so interesting. When I think about writing, so in my mind, in terms of the process, I have an image in my mind that I need to express with words. And I really, it's a need now. I denied it for a quadrillion years. And now when people say to me, you know, what do you do? I always say I'm a writer first. You know, where I used to kind of say, oh, no, I'm a, oh. And what I find, though, is that if there's an idea to be expressed, it's like an itch, kind of like it bothers me. It's there with me at night. It's there with me in the morning until it's actually out. I want to know about creating art because I'm not artistic in the way that you are. What is that process?
First of all, I would encourage all people to explore the creative and artistic proclivities they would have that they don't think they do have. When people say, I'm not an artist, I say, I beg to differ.
In the way most you are, yeah.
Well, no, most people really have the knowledge, they can distill knowledge. What they don't have is the practical. They don't know how to do it. But if, as a mature person, one is not inhibited creatively, I mean, people can do everything. The other thing, which is extremely important, I mean, probably one of the greatest artists or creative impetus that, say, Einstein would have had would be very similar to that of a painter. It's just that he happened to do it with
numbers
and mathematics. But there's no difference. In fact, we all have it.
I don't know that we all do, actually.
Well, really with things like, let's say, Renaissance painters, which are always sort of seen as the great masters, I actually in part agree with that. Many people in the Renaissance, Italian Renaissance, which is, shall we say, circa sort of 1500 and earlier, many people that would really come out of nowhere could apprentice to a master and become, if not Da Vinci, very credible. You learn it.
Of course.
And I actually believe as well, charisma, the ability to entertain, showmanship, much can be taught. Don't think it's just all natural. Some people can't, but many can if they have a muse or a mentor that could help them do it. If we're not sort of going across the board too much, there was something really figure skating here which was conspicuous, my understanding of it. The two most interesting programs as far as lack of inhibition and entertainment, one came from Uzbekistan and one came from Kazakhstan.
Dennis Tan.
But that flies in the face of what we would think, because before we would think those would have come from America or maybe France or maybe even Canada. But in fact, the dial has changed. Again, someone tapped into the abilities of these two young male skaters and pushed buttons that in a way flew in the face of their culture, really.
Yes, yep.
Because they were more American, more Hollywood, more kind of television than any of the North Americans that you would think would exhibit that. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my questions was going to be, as a very young child, you were obviously an artistic child. I want to know if there was a defining moment where you went from being artistic child to artist.
That is a really heavy and interesting conversation. I don't think there would have been a defining moment because congenitally, I would have been that. There were many defining moments with regard to what can really only be described as the most turbulent skating career in history. I mean, against all odds, I persevered, and where some skaters, world and Olympic champions, evaporate, you know, after their glory. Mm-hmm. I mean, I limped along for another 25 years.
Hardly limping.
No, but I mean, if you can imagine that, it's quite fantastic. And that would have been propelled and driven by an artistic inclination.
Okay.
I when all is said and done, have to accept the fact, I think it's true, that I was an artist that happened to skate.
Yeah.
It actually came, that came first, way before the skating. It wasn't the opposite. And another thing that I think propelled me along that narrative was my inability, as it turned out, for whatever reason, to achieve certain things. I mean, achieve status, sort of, with the establishment. I didn't do it, and I wasn't good at it. And one thing that happened, which actually was a defining moment, horrible as it may be, was in 1968, which was an Olympic year. I don't think you were born at that time.
Bless you for saying that.
But what happened, it's so awful, it's so terrible, it's actually quite fantastic. In the senior men's competition...
At Canadians?
Yes, in 1968. I had marks, and there were 20 competitors, from first until last. From one...
Really?
...until 20. And that is so controversial, really. Actually, so cruel to... Mm-hmm. I don't know, I was 17 or something. It's really, really hard to digest. But that said... That event and what happened to me was the fuel that, you know, pushed me on for the next 50 years or something. The energy of controversy, I would say. I mean, something which is very funny, I think that we, and anybody that, I mean, a rebel with a cause or a rebel without one, I was both. We are looking and lusting for the pat on the head. We want to be appreciated either by the peers or particularly establishment. That is what we're after. But that said, once you get it, you're rendered impotent. You cannot go any further. In skating with Paul and Isabel Deshaney, of whom I'm a great fans of them. But the thing is, they like me, but me before them, was fabulous at losing competitions. I really was quite good at it. And my losses were spectacular. The few little wins that I had were completely unimportant and not interesting at all. In fact, not what I was known for. I was really good at losing. But that said, better at dealing with controversy.
Do you think, though, there's a part of me that believes that being somebody who loses, you have much more freedom in a way. Because if you had been the winner, quote-unquote, all of the time, you would have been painted into a box, I believe.
Well, there's a great deal of discussion about what does losing mean and what does winning mean. Mm-hmm. I really want to say this. In 25 years ago, with John Curry, who was my great adversary, and he did legitimately and wonderfully win the Olympics and then croaked 3 years after or whatever, and I didn't, and as I sort of mentioned the other night in the talk, was 2 inches below him on the podium. Mm-hmm. But I had lost and he had won. My life was, now what do I do? And his was, what can I do? Mm-hmm. As an Olympic champion has opportunities that third doesn't. But in that big picture, there's a book about him coming out from Great Britain. Years later, who wins and who loses, really?
Well, that's my point.
And so the loss actually morphs into a win, and the win morphs into a loss. And everything is contingent upon chronology and timing. In the immediate picture, if we win or if we lose, I'm talking competitions or whatever, it's painful because it's so immediate. Mm-hmm. But only in time and in age and with experience do you understand that the loss was the right thing. And in my case, without question, I would never have known it. To be perfectly honest, I really wasn't. I mean, if one can go back in the past, I wasn't really hungry to win. I really wasn't a competitor. I was an artist. And stupidly, I mean, this is ridiculous, I really liked my competitors and appreciated their performances. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't feel competitive with them. The only person I was competitive with was myself.
Is that still the case?
Yes.
So what is the driving force behind your art? When I was a kid skating, there was a, I don't know if it was the original or if it was a poster of the Strawberry Queen in the ladies' change room at the cricket club. I used to stare at that for, I can't tell you how long. I love the detail of it. But that's the way, I mean, I love things that have great detail. I love finding things that I didn't see before. And I see in your art now, what I feel about it, as opposed to what I understand, is it feels much more kind of emotional or bold, or I don't really know exactly how
yes,
to describe it.
Yes, I think
it.
That. Well, look, in details, I actually lectured at Harvard once about this very thing. For a Canadian suburban boy that's a figure skater, that's not bad. There is actually a certain sort of sanctity or comfort in details. It's like animals going into caves. You know, it's comfortable in its littleness. Very hard for many. I'm learning it at this late age. Is it bolder and cleaner in concept? Is often a route to go, but that does not negate what was.
Mm-hmm.
With my work, that is very much still in keeping with the same style, but has changed, certainly.
Evolved.
You know, it's changed, and I'm not even a good judge of that. Yes, I guess evolved. And who's to say whether it's better or worse?
I think it's just different.
Well, it's, as Gertrude Stein said, everything's the same, but everything's different.
Yeah.
And within that vocabulary that I have, which, again, makes no sense, I said I'm suburban from Montreal, Bay d'Urfé. I enjoy, embrace the creative narrative of what is, yet I'm not really a good judge of it. But one must not, I think this is a fair thing to say, one must not, like a forest fire or a revolution, stand still. You have to keep moving, otherwise you die. And I think, for better or for worse, that my work with the 70,000 paintings out there continues to go somewhere within a certain mm-hmm. vocabulary.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. You appear to be the sort of person that has a brain that's working on several different levels at the same time.
Or not at all.
I don't believe that somehow. And you know what else? You have a tremendous playful side to you that I don't think that people can appreciate, because you are a very, very accomplished man, and with that comes a kind of intimidating quality for some people. And that, of course, just makes me want to talk to people like you more, to tell you the truth. Because at the end of the day...
Intimidation. One of the things, I go back, we're in London, and this is a point that I think is memorable and funny and historically accurate. In 1972, that was an Olympic year, it was Olympics in Sapporo. I also competed in London, but then strangely competed in London in 76 in order to get to Innsbruck.
Oh, really?
Yeah, two times in London. And Ellen Burka, who was, you know, the great teacher and trainer, in the London Gardens, which I think no longer exists, had to hide in the boiler room because she was too afraid that my performance would be terrible because I was breaking in a new pair of boots and I'd forgotten how to skate.
At Canadians?
Yes, right during the performance, breaking them in. Anyway.
That's crazy.
As it turned out, all's well that ends well, and I had received 6.0, that would have been a perfect mark at the time, from every judge. And then, because you're a Cricket Club girl, we returned home from that Sunday until Monday and stomped into the Cricket Club, sort of in tandem. And we're really hoping that the Cricket Club members would appreciate us, because after all, we did get 6.0 from every judge. Not one person even looked at us, and not one person complimented us. So, of course, we became fabulously paranoid and wondered why they hated us so much. As it turns out, years and years later, when I spoke to someone who had been there at the time, I said, you know, isn't it funny? Wouldn't you think someone would congratulate us or... She said, well, we were too afraid of you. And how would we have known at the time that we were the skating world's most intimidating couple?
But, I know.
But that said, what is perceived is not necessarily what is.
I know. That's my point.
And in fact, like all people, which could include, and he's much nicer than I am, but like a Patrick Chan or, I don't know.
Pick anybody.
Barack Obama, I mean, whatever, one cannot be absolutely certain that you know who they are. There's a public perception. But in fact, when all is said and done, whoever they are, and we do know this, people are just people, and people are also predictably human. And I had to, because of this very difficult position that I had in the skating world, and not really consciously flaunting authority, but having to survive, had to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
And that toughness would have been interpreted or misinterpreted as intimidation. But in fact, I'm just like everybody else, quite normal, in fact, probably more normal than one could imagine. And actually
so too.
Equally more boring, because when I say that, I do not have, did not have, a life that... I didn't have a secret life. I had a life that would have been the result of, or whatever it was that I accomplished, was the result of work. And once in this sort of movie that was being made in Mexico, and the guy was asking the staff that I have, like, who do I sleep with and what drugs do I take? I was really offended by that, because what I kept saying, sort of a voice in the wilderness, was, if you look around you and you see what I accomplish, what do you think I'm doing? Obviously, I'm doing whatever is necessary to accomplish.
It's work.
Work. And so again, the perception of something and the reality of something. I was really very good at it. The word eccentric is a word misused in the English language, because truly eccentric, of which I am not, couldn't be more boring, but the truly eccentrics, the great eccentrics of the world, it's unconscious. They don't know they are. I knew exactly what I was, and I used certain things, shall we say, eccentric elements to hone my image, to make it work for me. But as far as really being it, I couldn't have been more boring. And in some ways, the boy next door, in a way, because I was grounded, I'm like Patrick Chan. I mean, a worker.
And a kind person.
And a kind person, but I would have used elements and certain situations to work for me, either intimidate. But, you know, those are just that's artistic license.
Yeah. Do you know what's very interesting? When we had Carnival 100 years ago at the Cricket Club, you and I were backstage for whatever reason at one of the corner entrances. You were getting ready to come out and do a number, and I was, of course, in a group number long after that. But I remember standing there with you, and again, a kind, decent person. You're 10 years my senior, so when I was 11 years old or whatever, you would have been one of the big kids for sure. And you were talking about a crazy fan in Halifax that had come up to the Cricket Club for a Carnival show. At the time, there were no, you know, Stars on Ice, there were no professional shows. And you just sort of said it out of nowhere that this person, you were almost surprised at the interest that this person was showing you. A little scared, too, might I add. I will never forget the conversation.
Oh, well, I think, and we're going to wind up, but something that I've only really come to terms with of late, and on one point, and I don't compare myself to him, but Andre Agassi, in a somewhat recent autobiography, talked about how he really couldn't stand tennis. He hated it.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
And I sort of thought to myself, oh, gee, I think I'm the same.
Do you hate tennis?
No, figure skating. But, and part of me deeply, deeply and profoundly sort of kind of regrets having been one.
Really?
Part of me does. But that said, there were two major positives that were the result. One, the physical creativity of being creative every day, expressing yourself, was one of the huge perks. The other thing is, and this is the number one thing which sort of obviates the fact that I didn't have medals and didn't win and was not the establishment's favorite. And this is so important. I really wish I could tell other skaters and other athletes this, is it was the international cultural education that I received as a result of being a skater by going to so many different countries, experiencing different cultures, museums, architecture,
yes.
Whatever. That really was what I got. And that is so much more important than medals. The thing that I abjured, the thing that I really couldn't stand and to this day can't stand it, is the establishment within this sport, and that certainly during my reign, which was so hard to digest, was the fact that my destiny and future was being determined by people that knew nothing as compared to what I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had a hard time with that. It's now different, but shall we not mince words and talk about the past? Within a certain era, judges that would determine whether you would go to the Olympics or not, be Canadian champion or not, all came from Rosedale.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Now that is quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly during the, and I wasn't around in those days, but let's say the Barbara Ann Scott mm-hmm. days, maybe the Petra Burka days, the your social pedigree at that time was rather important.
Yes, that's true.
And it's really awful. But that said, times they are changing, sort of, kind of. I don't think the results change, but the times are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, you know, like slavery in America, if one could say that, one has to go through something in order to get somewhere else.
Okay.
And maybe I was just, you know, one of those people that today can be used as a kind of stepping stone, that I went through something, and it wasn't good for me, But today it's good for those people because they don't have to do that.
Yes, you changed the
story. So in a way, well, I don't know if I changed it, but I was part of a narrative that was necessary in order to get to where we are today.
I have two quick questions for you.
Yes.
May I please ask you to tell me, can you describe your relationship with Ellen Burka when you were a skater? She was your coach.
Well, Ellen Burka, I can't think of anybody really in the world that I admire more to this day, yet I don't speak to her. Ellen Burka, as a coach, was produced, I think, 35 Canadian champions, mm-hmm. world and Olympic medalists, et cetera, et cetera. It was most remarkable symbiotic relationship because we were sort of like Siamese twins, mismatched, albeit, but were necessary to each other. And one of the big sort of controversies of why we don't speak. And this bothers me a lot, but she was always saying, and it was interesting, sort of in essence, without me you'd be nothing. I mean, that would be something she would have said. I could actually return it and say, well, without me you'd be nothing. But in fact, it was together as teacher, pupil, pupil, teacher, together physically and intellectually and artistically, as a team, we did change the course of figure skating. And something which is much more important than she or me, I really feel this must be said.
Bigger than both of you?
Yes, bigger than both of us. It was the influence of both that spawned people like Sandra Bezek, Sarah mm-hmm. Kawahara, Laurie Nicol, who went on to mm-hmm. change the face of skating choreographically because those three...
have left their mark.
Have left a mark on the world.
Yep.
But it really did come from the cricket club, Osborne Colson, which was also part of that, Patrick Chan. And it's because of things like, if you recall, courses like Theater on Ice.
Yes.
That we would have embraced and studied, which went above and beyond just technical skating. But if you think of, and the cricket club doesn't really have a clue about this, but it's because of those people that were under the influence of Ellen, in part me, certainly Osborne Colson, that literally, in a draconian way, grasped the talent of the world. Boitano would be one, Yamaguchi another, Kurt Browning mm-hmm. another.
Patrick Chan.
Patrick Chan. And imagine that. And that, in the final analysis, is one on a very broad horizon, part of the Canadian legacy, but more specifically, my own and the cricket club's, which is where I came from. So if you'd really talk about a very small number of people that would have emanated from the club and also been pupils of Ellen Burka, it was they that changed the world and redefined skating in many years to come post
yes.
our participation in it. Maybe that's a good thing.
When, and this is my final question, when I interviewed you for my book, my question for all of my subjects was to finish the sentence, I am. You said, I am an alchemist. What I'd like to do is to ask you to give me the same kind of description, maybe three words, art is.
What is art?
For you.
Well, art is like a sort of living mirror, not inanimate. And art defines the individual in a sort of pristine way. And so for me, if you're still there, it is art that is the brushstrokes to define and illustrate the individual. And you can only really be that. I mean, you can be it innately, but it's like skating, it's like all things. As an artist, which is what I am, the more you do, the more precise the identity is or the image is. You really can't be an artist if you don't do it. You can think about it, but I'm a hands-on kind of guy, actually very pragmatic, very, very hands-on. And so as I do it, art defines who and what I am.
That's great. Tyler, thank you so much for talking to me. And if everybody wants more information, tylercranstonart.com is where you can go. And I, of course, will have everything on our website. Thank you for speaking to me. Well, Paul, I have to tell you, before I started the interview with Tyler, before the record button got pushed, we jockeyed a little bit for position, as you might expect. And what I appreciate about Tyler is the fact that when it was clear that I was going to ask the questions and he was going to have to answer, mm-hmm. Or that he was going to choose to answer, then he just sort of settled down. I had this experience when I interviewed subjects for my book. They all agreed to do it. And yet when it came down to the interview, some of the time you'd ask a question and they're kind of like try and figure out a way not to answer it.
Yeah.
And I just would sit there and sort of smile and then they'd eventually answer it. You know, coolest thing for me, Tyler paid me perhaps the highest compliment that he could pay anybody by saying to me that he thought that he and I were very much alike.
Mm-hmm. What did you think that meant to you when he
said
that?
For me, when you have somebody who is as big in the world as Tyler Cranston, to in any way liken another person to themselves,
mm-hmm.
If that's even a word, is really very flattering, because
yeah.
It means in some way he feels some sort of a connection, or feels that you're on some kind of level playing field, or that you're in some way a match for him maybe. So to feel that I'm in any way a match for Tyler Cranston is a huge compliment. I was thrilled.
Well, I don't know him personally, and I can't speak for to this, but I think sometimes people that are artists
and bigger than life, yeah,
they're also kind of almost insulating themselves against something.
Yeah.
And when you kind of do that, I think sometimes it's difficult to make a connection, make
yep.
a more, you know, a depth of a connection with other people, because, you know, you're sort of putting up this front all the time. So when you come across somebody like that, then it's a big deal.
And it's a fascinating way of trying to get to know other people, because you meet people and they don't even know what they do. And you know, in the interview when he was talking a little bit about himself and about his experiences with Mrs. Burka, and of course what's fascinating for me is to have him talk about that experience. And of course you have interviewed Mrs. Burka, and she comes in an upcoming episode and she talks about Tyler. So
mm-hmm.
to see how much they figured into each other's lives, again, very interesting. I felt really privileged. I felt like I was capturing part of skating history, because I really think that Tyler turned the corner with some other skaters like John Curry, but Tyler Cranston definitely was the one to turn the corner for men's figure skating. I really believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, I think it is very interesting, because we do have Ellen Burka coming up, and it's sort of this interesting sort of student coach thing, but there it's we'll see. I think it's all in how you want to kind of interpret things, and they really, what they say about each other, I think there's a deep respect for each other, and I think it's a very unusual relationship they sort of had. That they, I think Tyler sort of talked about this, that it was almost also timing that they found each other, and
yep.
they were able to, with each other's abilities and skills and what they could recognize in one another,
yep.
that it sort of, you know, there was a chemistry there that, that made all of this stuff happen.
Well, I think that I'm so thrilled that he allowed me to interview him. I'm so thrilled that I was able to catch up with him. And if people want to know more, of course, they can check our website and go to tollercranstonart.com. And Paul, if people want to get a hold of us, what are they going to do?
They have to, if you want to email us, it's contact@openkwongdoor.com, Twitter @openkwongdoor, and our website is openkwongdoor.com.
Thanks, everybody.